Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to two journalists, Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov.
Novaya Gazeta's journalists have long exposed high-level corruption and official lies.
A world without facts means a world without truth and trust.
Today, as the Nobel Committee says, press freedoms are necessary for both democracy and peace.
Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're at The Listening Post, where we don't cover the news, we cover the way the news is covered. Here are the media stories we're examining this week. The war against journalism results in Nobel Peace Prizes for two journalists, and there's plenty to read into this story. In Singapore, the authorities raise the specter of foreign interference to pass a new law that reporters don't like the look of. The games people play, the Pentagon included, the video game industry is proving to be a useful ally for the American military. And the journalist turned comedian who has become the go-to guy for Iraqis looking for political commentary with a little bite. The awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize for 2021 is a sign of the times and not a promising one. The two winners were both journalists, Filipino-American Maria Ressa and Russian Dmitry Muratov. It has been 85 years since the Peace Prize was last awarded to a journalist. It was back in the 1930s. Europe was tilting towards fascism, and a German news editor won it for his reporting on Adolf Hitler's Nazi movement. So the Nobel Committee's decision to recognize Ressa and Muratov amounts to a wake-up call over the state of global journalism. Ressa's news site, Rappler, and Muratov's newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, have stood up to harassment, repression, even death threats to expose corruption, the abuse of power, and state-sponsored disinformation. Which is why, when the offices of President Duterte and President Putin congratulated the new Nobel laureates, it rang more than just a little hollow, given that theirs is the kind of reporting that those leaders have tried to silence. We have two starting points this week, Manila and Moscow.
Two journalists covering different countries, defying different forms of authority. Both of them now Nobel laureates. Maria Ressa, co-founder and CEO of the Filipino news site Rappler, when she's not in court fighting off the Duterte government's efforts to throw her in jail. And Dmitry Muratov, editor of the Moscow-based Novaya Gazeta, a paper that still dares to be critical of those in power, even after having six of its reporters killed over a 10-year period. They are the first journalists to receive the Nobel Peace Prize since 1936, awards that amount to a shot in the arm for journalism and a slap in the face for governments out to stop it, committing crimes against it.
It showed that the importance of press freedom in our era, the fact that the Nobel Committee wanted to acknowledge that importance and the role that the media plays in an era and in a world that is confronting unprecedented challenges of an existentialist nature. Press freedom is under attack. It is in fact under unprecedented attack. The law has been weaponized to curtail the freedom of the media and the freedom to report.
All of these world leaders like Duterte, Putin, Narendra Modi, Bolsonaro, Trump, Sisi, they're all cut from the same cloth. And they should know that while they're trying to censor our voices, the world is noticing. The world noticed Maria Ressa's work while she was in the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov's work while he was in Russia. Because the Nobel Peace Prize is a huge, huge achievement and an accolade. And it's not just an award for Maria and Dmitry, it's an award for journalists who are under fire.
The Nobel Prizes put the spotlight squarely on two presidents who go after their journalistic critics in contrasting ways. Rodrigo Duterte is openly contemptuous of reporters. He galvanizes his base by attacking the news media and pursues journalists like Ressa through the courts when they refuse to stay silent. Vladimir Putin's government is more subtle, using its justice ministry to brand certain reporters and news organizations as foreign agents, effectively putting many of them out of business. So when the Nobel Prizes were announced, both governments had some serious spinning to do. The Kremlin initially offered Muratov its congratulations before the president reminded him that laws written in Moscow take precedence over awards handed out in Oslo.
А если он будет прикрываться Нобелевской премией как щитом для того, чтобы делать то, что нарушает российский закон, значит, он пойдет на это сознательно.
The official Filipino response was more brazen. The government tried to take credit for Ressa's award.
Press freedom is alive, and the proof is even the Nobel Prize award given to Maria Ressa.
If there was a Nobel Prize for hypocrisy, Rodrigo Duterte would be among the nominees.
A couple of years ago, I saw a press conference of Duterte when he was talking about the media and the press, and he showed his middle finger. This is a man, if he tries to co-opt this award for Maria Ressa, I think it's going to be a crime shame.
There was an attempt to highlight Maria Ressa's Nobel Prize win as evidence that everything is good in the Philippines. At the same time as this is happening, she's still facing decades in jail. She could potentially spend the rest of her life in a Manila prison if she's found guilty on all of the charges she currently has arrayed against her. The suggestion that Maria's victory is a victory for the Philippines government of Rodrigo Duterte in maintaining press freedom, that's a lie.
The Kremlin just did the minimum. It was required from it. On the very same day, another bunch of journalists were called for an agents as a schizophrenia. We praise the journalist who gets the Nobel Peace Prize. We say the right words, but the line, the policy is going to stay the same.
For both the Philippines and Russia, the Nobel Peace Prize are a blow to their image. So they're trying to PR, you know, their way out of this terrible publicity.
This could be a slap to Malacanang's face. Is it something that the government can be proud of?
Certainly not. It is not a slap in the government.
If they really care about that international recognition, then they need to prove it. They need to prove it by repealing in Russia the foreign agent law and the law that declares journalists undesirable. They need to prove it in the Philippines by lifting and getting rid of all those vexatious lawsuits against Maria.
The reporters working under Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov are up against online forces that align with the authorities and are sometimes paid by the state to discredit independent journalism. Ressa's is a case study in the kind of harassment reserved for female journalists. It's misogynistic and menacing. She's faced death threats, seen her home address posted online, and deep fake pornographic images of herself circulated on social media. It's a tactic designed to intimidate, and it knows no borders.
The online violence campaigns being waged against women journalists like Maria Ressa really operate at the intersection of misogyny and disinformation. We examined over 500,000 social media posts from Twitter and Facebook directed at her. 60% of those abusive posts were designed to try to erode credibility and trust in her journalism. So they called her a liar, a lying bitch often, because what they wanted to do was to weaponize misogyny as well as these anti-journalism, anti-free press narratives that they peddle.
I first met Maria Ressa about 6 years ago. At that point of time, I was under extreme pressure from the Indian government. My life had been made miserable, especially with multiple tactics of intimidation. My image was morphed on a porn video and it was circulated all over the country. And you feel like the government has put you out there in front of a virtual lynch mob. And I spoke to Maria and she said, I feel you, I've been there.
One cannot take the measure of the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize story without considering the timing. The last journalist to win the award was a newspaper editor. It was 1936. Karl von Ossietzky was German and got the news while locked up in a Nazi concentration camp.
We need to recall the climate in which the Nobel Prize in 1936 was given to the German journalist who was actually investigating the Nazi military activities. Given the fact that two brave journalists and editors-in-chief received that prize in 2021, means that we are in a kind of difficult world in terms of the freedom of speech.
It must feel to many journalists that they are operating in an incredibly difficult, dangerous, and toxic environment. So the Nobel Prize is in many ways an attempt to tell all of them, we've heard you, you're not alone, and we want to have your back. Together, we can say no to governments that are using the law or extralegal means to silence credible professional reporting. Together, we can stand up for press freedom. And I think that's what the Nobel Committee is inviting us all to do.
I think this is a very strategic decision by the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. They are signaling something very significant here, that there has never been such a convergence of threats to freedom of expression and to independent journalism, to critical journalism, and to the safety of journalists since World War II. Just think about that.
Turning to Singapore now, where the authorities are taking a page out of Moscow's playbook by passing a new foreign interference law that has some troubling implications for the news media. Nick Muirhead's been following this story. Nick, what are journalists seeing in this new law? What's the concern?
The new law is called FICA, the Foreign Interference Countermeasures Act, and it has journalists worried because in a country where the flow of information is already tightly controlled, the government now can make things a lot harder. FICA gives the authorities the power to block or censor online content. It can demand user information from internet companies. It can ban apps based on nothing more than a suspicion of foreign interference. Furthermore, the government can designate an individual or an organization as politically significant, meaning that they are then closely monitored. And once you go onto that list, it's very difficult to come off. The only way to do it is not through the courts, but through the government.
Not a list that you want your name on then.
No.
So what is the criteria for being deemed politically significant?
Well, that's the other troubling aspect here, Richard. The wording of FICA is vague and therefore open to interpretation, and that is by design. The country's Minister of Home Affairs said that foreign meddlers often hide behind seemingly legitimate fronts. He said the language has got to be broad enough to cover that what is apparently normal but is actually not normal. And there are severe punishments for falling afoul of FICA. If an individual is found guilty of publishing information, political information, for a foreign principal, they can face fines of up to $75,000, and for organizations, it's $750,000.
So what are journalists saying about the law, or are they watching their words?
It sounds like it. Kumaran Pillai, he works for a website called The Independent Singapore. He told Al Jazeera that whether intentional or not, the government is setting up barriers to entry in the media landscape in Singapore, which speaks to the larger problem here. For decades, the media in Singapore has been a virtual duopoly. Singapore Press Holdings, that dominates the print side, and over in broadcast, it's a company called MediaCorp. Both companies claim to have editorial independence, but they have very close ties to the government. So it is unlikely that they will fall afoul of FICA, but the same cannot be said for other journalists and news organizations in Singapore.
Okay, thanks, Nick. Anyone familiar with the term the military entertainment complex knows it was coined for Hollywood and the symbiotic relationship that movie studios have long had with the Pentagon. The blockbuster films that glorify American soldiers, subsidized by U.S. taxpayers through all the military hardware that the Pentagon makes available at no cost, as long as the producers make them look good. However, the military entertainment complex encompasses more than just film and television. Video games now rake in far more money than the film industry does, and the pandemic has given the gaming industry a boost. All those people stuck at home with idle thumbs. Given the demographics at play, the legions of young players at the controls, the U.S. military is in on that action as well. The gaming world is now a prime recruiting ground. It's a trend that many Americans, from the gaming community to the halls of Congress, are out to stop. The Listening Post's Daniel Turi now on the military gaming complex and the messages it is beaming into American homes.
We cannot conflate war and military service with this kind of gamified format. And with that,
July 2020, the US Congress is debating its annual military spending bill. The issue in question, the Pentagon's deployment into competitive online gaming, esports, in order to recruit young Americans.
Right now, currently, children on platforms such as Twitch are bombarded with banner ads that link to recruitment sign-up forms that can be submitted by children as young as 12 years old.
It began back in 2018. After spending the better part of two decades mired in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Army missed its recruitment target by a distance. Rather than rely on the methods of old, blitzing the American airwaves with TV ads, the Pentagon turned to a platform called Twitch. Estimated number of daily users, 15 million.
Twitch is like a digital version of hanging out on the couch with your friends, watching them play video games. So there's one person that's kind of in control of the stream, they're playing a video game, and there's a chat room running on the side, and you talk to them. This new social media that's really taken over in the last few years. So in order to get into that space and talk to kids, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the National Guard have all started esports teams.
Esports, people might be really surprised to realize, is one of the fastest growing sectors in the world in terms of entertainment. There are a lot of younger people watching esports, and of course, in the era of the electronic battlefield, the idea of having technologically literate and technologically savvy recruits is obviously really, really important. So that's exactly why you would go there.
The idea that this is all about recruitment has been met with military denials, like this one from a member of the Navy's esports team.
No, we're not here to recruit. That is not the point of this.
That's not what the Navy's official Twitch manual says. It states that, quote, everything done on social media should be aimed at making connections between prospects and recruiters. While the Pentagon was new to esports and Twitch in 2018, it was already a video game veteran. In 2002, 1 year into the Bush administration's so-called War on Terror and a vast recruitment drive, the military released a game of its own, America's Army, now in its fourth edition.
They spent $7-8 million in its setup, and they produced that game as a strategic communication tool with a very high quality development team. Now, in terms of its reach, estimations are that about 18 million people have had an account. The US military itself have done evaluations of the game and regard it as, quote unquote, one of the most successful recruitment tools that they themselves have ever devised.
Most importantly, America's Army is free. So in an era where, video games cost $50 and $60, if you can get something like America's Army that's comparable to the best shooters out there for free, then you're gonna get it, especially if you're 16 and you don't have a whole lot of disposable income.
America's Army is an anomaly in the gaming world. Most games are produced independently, and they have never been more popular. In terms of revenue, the video games industry is now larger than the movie and music sectors combined, with 2.5 billion players around the world. That includes 2 in every 3 Americans. And franchises where you play a US soldier or spy, like Call of Duty or Battlefield, regularly top the charts.
I know you won't fail us.
Which leads game developers to work closely with military consultants, who also contribute to the storylines. And it's here that the US military and intelligence agencies score another win. Depictions of American history that airbrush their actions and demonize their enemies.
This is Call of Duty Black Ops, one of the best-selling games of all time.
I'm playing as a CIA officer during the Bay of Pigs invasion, the real-life attempt by the US to overthrow the Cuban government in the 1960s. My mission is to kill Fidel Castro, just as the real CIA tried and failed to do. But the game adds a fictional motive for the murder. Here, the virtual Castro is involved in a plot to ship a chemical weapon to the Vietnamese, which conveniently gives the US a pretext for the next thing you do in the game, invade Vietnam.
A new Call of Duty comes out every year. In 2019, we've got Modern Warfare, and in this game, is a mission called the Highway of Death, where you are in a fictional Middle Eastern country, and in the universe of the video game, Russia had invaded this country.
If they try to escape to the mountains, there is only one road, Tariq al-Mut, the Highway of Death. The Russians bombed it during the invasion, killing the people trying to escape.
Now, that happened in real life, but America did it during the first Gulf War. After Saddam's army was defeated and it was retreating out of Kuwait, the American military bombs the army as it's retreating.
They were hit where they stood, first by U.S. bombs, then by tanks.
But because this is a Call of Duty game and because America can't do any wrong, that atrocity has to be pulled out and reattributed to Russia.
I grew up Dutch, Dutch-Egyptian, and that meant that at some point in my life I started realizing that in most of these games I was playing as people that looked like my Dutch friends.
English, ass. We know you speak it.
And I was always shooting people that looked like my Arab friends. And over time, I've kind of come to realize that the only way you can portray something like the US military as an absolute good is if you flatten everything else into an absolute evil. So the Arabs, the Russians, the South Americans sort of get flattened into this nest of evil, of terrorism that the US military goes and straightens out.
Launching camera.
There have been exceptions. Spec Ops: The Line, released in 2012, highlights the human cost of war. It even shows US soldiers using the deadly chemical white phosphorus as they did in the real Iraq War.
Through the game, the player is both figuratively and psychologically destroyed by the violence that they commit.
You don't mind me asking, what was it like? How'd you survive all this?
Who said I did?
Now, what is really interesting as well is that this is a game made by a German developer. So it raises some quite interesting issues about perspective there, about whether it took a German developer to make that game. And it also is interesting because not very many games like that have been made since.
It's important to realize that video games are obviously this mix of art and technology and commerce, and that in the end, a lot of these games cost tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to make. So for every game that gets to play a little bit more risky with their narrative, there will also be a number of games that tell the same old story that gamers recognize and that they have come to be comfortable in.
Over the past two decades, the Pentagon has proven itself to be more adept at public relations than it has been at fighting wars. Despite the calamitous failures in Iraq and Afghanistan, support for the military has stayed consistently high. There's no way to quantify how much video games have to do with that, but if you follow the money, the Pentagon clearly thinks they're worth the investment. It has a new game in production, America's Army 5. As for esports,
now, this amendment is specifically to block recruitment practices and funding for recruitment practices on platforms such as Twitch.tv.
Congress voted that amendment down, leaving the military free to continue its virtual offensive. For now, at least, the military gaming complex is here to stay.
And finally, Iraq has just held a general election where one of the issues was apathy, low voter turnout. Just 41% of those eligible to cast a ballot did so. For many Iraqis, a popular source of information on the elections was the Al-Bashir Show. It's a satirical program that goes out on the Arabic language service of the German public broadcaster, Deutsche Welle. created in 2014 by Iraqi journalist turned comedian Ahmed al-Bashir. The show racks up millions of views, primarily on YouTube, which is where most Iraqis catch it. We're closing with a clip of al-Bashir's election commentary on Iraq's female candidates, some of the bizarre campaign videos that they put out. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.
وفي إطار جهود الخالات للتقنية الفقير بالانتخابات دخلت على خط المنافسة الحاصلة على جائزة أوسكار في الآداب الست حذام.
أنا حذام إسماعيل العبادي، مديرة مدرسة إعلامية، كاتبة صحفية، شاعرة، رسامة، عضو بشبكة الصحفيات العراقيات، عضو بنقابة الصحفيين العراقيين، عضو بنقابة المعلمين.
رئيسة مدفعية، آمرة كتيب الدبابات، قائدة فرقة المجوقلة 511، قطان باخرة، مديرة محطة قطارات العلاوي، طبيبة أسنان وطب أعشاب، مهندسة ديكور حاسبات، علوم فيزياء، علوم اللغة العربية. ست حذام، أنت بس البشير شو ما قدمتي. وهذا الإعلان يأخذنا إلى إعلان قريب جدا من هذا الموضوع.
ناسك مهدي التي ستخوض الانتخابات البرلمانية لأول مرة سعيا لتغيير واقع مدينتهم.
ذهب تبع لهم ويرهب يوم المهرب فتحنا سمع ورجل على القاع.
بس ملاحظة مهمة جدا، هذا مو أستاذ ناسك مهدي، هذا اللي تشوفوه، هذا اللي دي يسوي إعلان مرته مرشحة، مو هو يعني، وما له علاقة. الموضوع مو غريب بالعراق، لأنه المرة من تموت ما يكتبون اسمها على القطعة، يكتبون عقيلة فلان وبنت فلان. تريد من ترشح يطلعوها تلتقي بالناخبين؟ ما عندنا نسوان يطلعن بالانتخابات أبويا.